But a solid, there in most cases, the solid is even more packed together. Plus, they're not changing places with each other like they are in a liquid. They're still moving, they're rattling, but they're held in position, basically. And therefore, for most substances, the solid is the densest of the three states. But that's not true for water. And you know this from personal experience. If you make yourself a glass of ice water, you have pure water there. I mean, it would be pure if you used distilled water. It's nothing but water, though, is what I'm saying. In both cases, you just have two states of water, liquid and solid. But as you already know, the ice cubes, which is the solid water, float. Well, almost anything else, if you put a solid of that stuff into a liquid, you take a pinball, a steel sphere, and you put it into molten steel, with liquid steel, it's going to sink. Because it's more dense than the liquid, like almost all substances are. But not with water. And that is very important biologically. We really wouldn't be here without this fact. If you consider a body mixture, which is the solute, well, water is not the only solvent, but it is an important solvent, and it is also highly versatile, meaning that a lot of things are able to dissolve well in water, including, as you see here, salts. What's another name for salts? No, that's just an example of a salt. Ionic compounds are salts. You can use those terms relatively, mainly interchangeably. So sodium chloride is just one of many salts, but the same is true for salts in general. They are ionic compounds, which means they're made out of ions, right, that have full charge. So they have charge just like water has partial charge, only the ions have full charge, like you were investigating in today's lab. But whether it's full or partial, charges that are opposite attract. And that's why you have hydrogen bonding, to begin with, between water molecules that are partially charged. But you can also have attraction between a water molecule that is polar and an ion that is beyond polar, fully charged. So, first of all, remember that ionic compounds don't form molecules, right? They're ionic bonds, and you can make a chunk of that stuff as big as you want, as long as you have enough ions, because they're all connected. It's not like molecules that have a predefined size for each particle. Is that clear? So this is a piece of still solid salt that hasn't been dissolved yet. That's the close-up of the cartoon. But when you put a salt into water, it really doesn't remain as an ionic compound when it dissolves. Dissolving means that you separate the ions from each other, keep them from forming those ionic bonds. You separate them as ions separately. They're still ions. They're just not connected together anymore. Instead, they're enshrouded or surrounded by water molecules. So after the dissolution or the dissolving, what you have really is, in this case of sodium chloride, sodium ions in solution and chloride ions in solution. You no longer have sodium chloride. But the reason water works well for this is because at the surface of the chunk of salt, however big it is, there are both positively and negatively charged ions on that surface, of course. And water is nice and small and can get in there, and because of its partial charges, attract away an ion at a time, like this chloride ion that used to be on the surface, and now it's been picked away and surrounded, not only in two dimensions like you see here, but it would be a sphere all the way around chloride, a sphere of water molecules, each swiveled so that the partially positive hydrogen end of the water molecule is attracted to the negative chloride ion, keeping that chloride ion from interacting with sodium ions. And the same thing's true for the sodium ions that get picked off. It's just that the water molecules surrounding the positive ion are swiveling so that the partially negative oxygen end of the molecule is being attracted to the positive ion. So salts or ionic compounds in general dissolve very well in water. Water makes an excellent solvent for those. In 7, we see that it goes beyond that. Water is also a good solvent for other things, including, importantly, biologically, proteins. We'll investigate proteins in much greater detail after this upcoming test, but proteins are enormous molecules compared to water, as you can see here in the cartoon version, and they are indispensably important to biology, proteins are, because they do all the important jobs in a cell. But you have them, for instance, in your blood. Those are called plasma proteins because plasma is the liquid component of blood outside of the blood cells. The liquid component of blood is mostly water. And those proteins that are also in there are at least partially dissolved by water because, for reasons we'll get into later, a typical protein at its surface has partial positives and partial negative charges, depending on the amino acids that are the building blocks that make up that particular protein. You can see that on the right edge here. This is just one little piece of the surface of the overall big protein. It happens to be partially positive here and partially negative here. Well, water molecules come around and do the same thing they would with ions, only with positive charges. This one's swiveling, so its partial negative is right up against that partial positive. This one's swiveling so that its partial positive is right up against the partial negative. And similarly, all the way around it. So it's a shroud of water molecules around that protein. Okay, now to 8. Here we have an illustration of something that's important about water, or a population of water molecules, that is, which is called the auto-ionization of water. And so what does auto mean? Self, right. Auto-ionization refers to the fact that if you have a population of pure water, no other kinds of molecules, just nothing but water molecules, some, not even close to all, a tiny fraction, but some of those water molecules at any given moment will form ions by themselves. All right? And that's why it's called auto-ionization. We can see here that you start out with two normal water molecules. Each one is an H2O. But it's possible for this reaction to occur. Notice it's a reversible reaction. That's why there's not just one direction to the arrow. It can happen either way. But if you think about it happening toward the right, you have these two ordinary water molecules that are going to undergo a transfer of a proton. Now, first of all, think about a hydrogen atom. A hydrogen atom is part of a water molecule, right? But just imagine a hydrogen atom by itself. What makes up a hydrogen atom in terms of particles? You stopping there?
One proton, one neutron?
It's possible. There is an isotopic version of hydrogen called heavy nitrogen that has a neutron as well, but the vast majority of hydrogen atoms that you would encounter in nature don't have a neutron.
I think it's called deuterium, right?
Right. So, in normal cases, a hydrogen atom is simply a proton and an electron, and that is it. Right? It has to have the proton, otherwise it's not hydrogen. But it has a proton and an electron. That's the entire atom. And those are both there in this molecule. A proton and electron for this hydrogen, a proton and electron for that hydrogen. Okay, well, what's being transferred here is just the proton of just one of the hydrogen atoms from one of the water molecules to the other water molecule. So the proton gets transferred, the electron from that hydrogen gets left behind, which, by the way, should make sense to you because oxygen has a high electronegativity. So it will hang on to that electron. The proton, though, gets transferred to the other one. And that transfer of a proton, in this case, simultaneously turns both of these originally normal water molecules into ions. Because the one that receives the extra proton from the other molecule is now an H3O plus. It's an ion because you've added a positive here, but you didn't also bring a negative. Right? That's a hydronium ion. And the one that lost the proton now has one extra electron that it doesn't have a proton for to counteract. And so it's an OH negative, a hydroxide ion. That's what autoionization is. And this does happen, but when it happens, a hydronium ion typically can lose the proton that it just received, and the proton will just be an ion on its own. Okay? Now, this brings up an important point. If you are a hydrogen atom, which we just said starts out as a proton and an electron, and that's it. That's the whole atom, right? If a hydrogen atom loses an electron, it has lost all of its electrons because it only has one. And since it doesn't have a neutron, the only thing that's left when a hydrogen atom loses an electron is a proton. Well, I'm mentioning this because a proton is also called a hydrogen ion. A hydrogen ion and a proton are the same thing, right? And their symbol is H+. So you should equate these three names in your mind. H+, proton, and hydrogen ion all mean the same thing. And when you read H+, it's typically you would read it, not say it, just know that that means proton and it means hydrogen ion. They're all the same thing. Okay, so what I was talking about, hydronium losing the proton, you can really think of autoionization happening with just one water molecule as well. So you have a water molecule to begin with, that's H2O, and it can become, by losing a proton by itself, the one that was lost, which is the hydrogen ion, and what's left after the water molecule loses that proton, which is a hydroxide ion. Now, importantly, if all you have is water, which I said we do in this example, notice that you can't make just one of these kinds of ions. If you form a hydrogen ion with pure water, you have to also make a hydroxide ion because you simultaneously make both. And therefore, in a sample of pure water, however many hydrogen ions there are, there's that same amount of hydroxide ions. All right? Now, I'm saying this because it'll make it easier to understand the pH scale, which is what all of this autoionization is important for, and that's shown in slide 9. More generally, though, let's just talk about P scales in general. The pH scale is just one of many P scales that humans have devised. We make P scales mainly for convenience when we're dealing with very small numbers over and over. It becomes just a pain in the ass to work with very small numbers if over and over. Just writing them down, for instance, right? If you have a very, very tiny number, like 10 to the negative 16th, you don't want to keep writing 0.15 zeros and then 1. So that's why P scales are invented, to work with those tiny numbers and make them more manageable, even though that's really the same values. All right, so pH is just one of those examples, and pH is the P scale for hydrogen ion concentration. That's what the H stands for in pH. And it has this mathematical definition. pH is equal to the negative base 10 logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration. Now, in chemistry, if we're talking about concentration, we symbolize that with square brackets. Everything inside the square brackets means the concentration of whatever is in those brackets. In this case, just this part of it, ignoring the other, just the square brackets H plus means hydrogen ion concentration by itself. All right, we'll talk more about this in a second. But notice that P scales are logarithmic scales as opposed to linear scales. We're used to using linear scales, like a meter stick, for instance. A linear scale is a scale in which every increment not only looks the same size, but is the same size, right? You look at a meter stick, every centimeter is the same size. Well, a logarithmic scale, that's not true. Even though the steps might look the same size when you look at the scale, in a logarithmic scale, every step is 10 times bigger than the previous step. So it's based on powers of 10 rather than adding one more. All right? And most people in daily life are not very used to using logarithms, even though I'm sure you've learned them at one point in grade school or high school or whatever. So let me quickly review what a logarithm is. And you can use anything as a base for a logarithm, but that's why I said the base 10 logarithm, which is usually just written as log, sometimes as log subscript 10 to show you that it's the base 10. But anyway, I'll give you the definition for the base 10 logarithm. The logarithm of a number, let's say x. X is the original number. The log of that number is the exponent that you have to raise the base to, which is 10. You have to raise 10 to some exponent in order to equal that original number, x. Okay? The log of a number is what you have to raise 10 to in order to equal that number. So based on that definition, what is the log of a million?
Six.
Because a million is 10 to the sixth. You have to raise the base, which is 10, to the sixth power to equal that number. And the log of 1,000 is 3, right? Because 1,000 is 10 to the third. The log of 100 is what? 2. And what about the log of 1? 0, because 1 is 10 raised to the 0 power. What about 1/10? -1, because 1/10 is 1 over 10 to the 1, which is 10 to the -1. Once again, the log is what is the exponent you have to raise 10 to. So in this case, it would be -1. Okay. That's enough of a background on logs. The pH scale, which is a scale used to determine whether a solution is acidic and how acidic it is, or whether it is the opposite of acidic, which is basic or alkaline, and how alkaline it is. So it's important for solutions, the pH scale is. But you probably already know that the pH scale is centered on 7. And maybe you thought, what pain in the ass did this? It makes no sense for it to be centered on 7. Well, that's not something we decided on. That comes straight from a measurable property of water, namely the autoionization. So if you have pure water under standard conditions, nothing but water, that autoionization will happen. But as I said before, only to a tiny fraction of the population. At any given moment, if you were able to stop time and go in there and look at individual molecules, almost all of them would be normal water molecules. But a measurable and repeatable fraction of the population would be undergoing autoionization. All right? And therefore, pure water is not really pure water molecules. It's a solution of water and hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions, right? Because of autoionization. Well, you can measure what the concentration of hydrogen ions in pure water is. And when you measure it, it's 10 to the negative 7th molar of hydrogen ion. The hydrogen ion concentration, in other words, is 10 to the negative 7th molar. That's a direct measurement of water under standard conditions. Okay? So that's the part in brackets, 10 to the negative 7th. If you look at the definition of pH, never mind the negative, what is the log of 10 to the negative 7th? What did we just say the log is? The log is the exponent you have to raise 10 to in order to equal the number. So what's the log of 10 to the negative 7th? No, that's just 10 to the negative 7th in a different format. Yes. The number you have to raise 10 to in order to equal 10 to the negative 7th is negative 7. Right? So the log of 10 to the negative 7th is negative 7. That would be the log of the hydrogen ion concentration in pure water. But the pH scale is devised as the negative of the log so that we don't always have to deal with negative numbers. The P scales are invented for convenience. So when you take the negative of the log of the hydrogen ion concentration, it's negative negative 7, which makes it 7. That's why the pH scale is centered on 7. It's based on pure water. Okay? Now, what if this is a pH of 7 is neither acidic nor basic. It's neutral. And there's different ways in chemistry that you can define acids, but the most fundamental one, the one that you learn first in chemistry, is that an acid is a hydrogen-containing substance that, when you put into water, will break apart into a hydrogen ion that came from the acid and everything else. In other words, when you put an acid into water, you already have a hydrogen ion concentration because of autoionization of water itself. And then you add additional hydrogen ions that came from the acid. And therefore, the hydrogen ion concentration of that solution is even higher than it would be in pure water. Does that make sense? All right, let's say you put such an acid into water, and you put enough of it so that you make the hydrogen ion concentration 10 times as much as it was in pure water. Pure water has a concentration of hydrogen ion concentrations of 10 to the negative 7th molar. What is 10 times that concentration? When you multiply 10 to the negative 7th by 10, look at it in standard notation. 10 to the negative 7th is 0.000001. When you multiply that by 10, what do you get?
10 to the negative 6.
Yes, because you're moving this one place, right? So this is 10 to the negative 7th. If you make it 10 times as big, it's 0.000001, which is 10 to the negative 6th. Okay? 10 to the negative 6th is 10 times bigger than 10 to the negative 7th. Well, what is the log of 10 to the negative 6th? Negative 6. And therefore, the negative of the log is negative negative 6, which is 6. This is why the more acidic a solution gets, the smaller the number gets on the pH scale. because six, a pH of 6 is really corresponding to a 10 to the negative 6th concentration, which is 10 times bigger than 10 to the negative 7th. It's just because of how we devise the scale, so we don't have to deal with negatives. All right? And by the way, there's nothing saying that 0 is a limit or that 14 is a limit in the other direction. Just most things are within that very wide range. The important number is 7, which comes directly from a property of water. It's not that we decided on 7. Okay, so anything that's numerically below 7 is acidic. And if you go from a pH of 7 to 6, that's 10 times the concentration. A pH of 5 seems like the same size jump, but as I was saying, it's a logarithmic scale. So a pH of 5 is 100 times as acidic as 7, 10 times as much as 6. Every time you make one jump, you're going 10 times more concentrated in hydrogen ions. If you go numerically above 7, then it's an excess of hydroxide ions instead of an excess of hydrogen ions. And those solutions, we say, are basic or alkaline. And bases are substances that, when you put them into water, break into hydroxide ions and everything else that's in that substance. Okay, so that's the way it works. And this has implications in biology because... slide 10, let me just say I'm on slide 10. This is the pH scale just with some familiar examples. But anyway, the reason that pH is so important in biology is because of what life is. I keep saying that life is metabolism, right? Life really is just the chemical reactions that are occurring in cells, which is metabolism. And more specifically, that chemistry of life is aqueous solution chemistry. So these are not reactions that are occurring as solids on lab benches. These are occurring in liquid solutions, and specifically the liquid solvent in these solutions is water. That's what aqueous solution means. An aqueous solution is a solution in which water is the solvent. That's true for all of metabolism. All cells have their chemistry occurring in aqueous solution. And the pH of that solution can drastically affect how those reactions occur, for one thing. That's one of the reasons pH is so important. Another reason, though, is that even a small change in pH can drastically change the shape of proteins. And as we'll learn, proteins, which do all the important jobs in organisms, individually have whatever their function is because of the specific shape of that protein. And therefore, if that shape gets changed, it will no longer be able to do that job, whatever it's for, and the organism will die. Before I get to the next picture, though, notice that here at pH 2, and it can be even lower than that, is gastric juice, which is in your stomach. This is why your stomach is by far the most inhospitable place in your body to other organisms. Now, there are plenty of organisms living in and on you that you need, and it's a good thing that they're there, but there are also some things out there that can harm you, of course, as we know in the midst of a pandemic. Well, you have things sticking to your throat all the time, but they stick because of the mucus, and then we swallow intermittently throughout the day to deliver these potentially harmful things, bacteria and whatnot, to the stomach, because very few species can survive that low a pH. It's the garbage disposal of your body when it comes to getting rid of pathogenic invaders. But the next slide, 11, which I think is the last of the show, shows you a forest that hopefully I don't have to tell you is not healthy. You can tell by looking at these trees are in trouble. And that's because of acid precipitation or acid rain. Precipitation is water that falls from the sky, of course, and normal precipitation is more or less water. But when pollutants are added into the air, for instance, sulfur-containing compounds, which you find in diesel fuel, and factories emit a lot of sulfur for various reasons. When that gets put into the air and mixes with the water of raindrops, it's no longer the same sulfur compound. It becomes sulfuric acid. So the raindrop is not water anymore. It's an acid solution. And that falls onto the forest wherever it happens to rain, which is not necessarily the place where the pollution was. And that pH change is something that the plants can't cope with because of these, for among other things, these protein shape changes that can occur because of pH changes. And so that's just one example of why pH is so important. But in general, it's an important variable, pH is, in homeostasis for any organism. Organisms can only live in a narrow range of pH, which is why any given organism does what it can to make sure that the pH doesn't get too high or too low. This, by the way, is the reason why you cannot hold your breath after a certain point. A lot of people think that you hold your breath for so long and you just eventually have to breathe because you're out of oxygen. That's not true. You have a lot of oxygen left. The problem with holding your breath is that you're no longer exhaling CO2, and it builds up in your blood instead. And CO2 mixed with water makes carbonic acid, which changes the pH of your blood. It makes it more acidic. And just a tiny, tiny decrease in pH, or increase in acidity, is detected by the base of your brain, and it tells you, I don't care what you want to do, you're going to have to breathe now to get rid of this CO2.
And that's why, like, you'll pass out a blood circulation cutoff and you're not breathing.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, a deprivation of oxygen is also bad, of course, but if you're already dead from pH, it doesn't matter whether you have oxygen.